So, today I'm interviewing a woman who is half French and half Cumbrian. That's in the north of England. She was brought up in London. She studied philosophy and theology at Oxford. She trained for the priesthood at Ripon College, Oxford University. She is a priest, an Ignatian spiritual director, a therapist, and a duty chaplain at Westminster Abbey. Oh, and her dad also is Melvin Bragg. She is Marie-Elsa Roche Bragg, and today we're talking about, I think it's your first novel, is that right? Towards Mel Brecq. Now I'm wondering, hi, and welcome to Radio Gorgeous, by the way.
Lovely to be here, thanks.
Do you pronounce it Mel Brecq or Mel Brake?
I would probably normally say Mel Brecq, but if you were an old Cumbrian from a different generation, you'd definitely say Mel Brecq.
Oh, so that sounds slightly Scottish, doesn't it?
Like we roll our R's and got our own numerical system, own language, really, that generation. Fantastic. Like if you count to five, you'd say Yan Tian Tether Mither Pimp. It's all a proper language.
And it really does sound to me very, kind of like Icelandic or something.
Yeah, you can see that.
In fact, I do remember, when I was in Iceland, it said that there is a link to Cumbria and Iceland with the language. Yeah. So I wonder who went each way. Did someone come from Iceland to Cumbria, or do you think Cumbrians went to Iceland?
I don't know. I mean, all the influences, you know, the Norse and the Saxons. I mean, there's a great history, even just written in the place names. It's, I don't know. I think lots of people travelled to there to make a new life, thinking that they were going, you know, away from battles or taking over villages.
They wanted to have a nice, quiet life.
Yeah,
so, where is Mel Brecq and what does Mel Brecq mean?
Well, the word Mel Brecq means dawn breaking on a fell.
Mm.
So, Mel is the word for dawn or yellow.
Wonderful.
Or bright yellow, and Brecq is break. And Mel Brecq itself is this beautiful mountain and valley just next to Crummet Water in the northwestern fells, which is where I'm from. And Crummet Water is a lake that I've just sort of loved all my life. It's very quiet. It's next to Buttermere. Buttermere is the popular lake. And Crummet Water is the quiet, beautiful one. But if you're a local, you do notice that even when it's raining and heavy clouds everywhere, there's often sunlight in Mel Brecq Valley. And I think that's probably how it got its name.
Oh, how charming. So this is a generational story. Obviously, we won't go too much into it. Don't want to give it away. But it starts in the spring of 1971. Can you explain the family tree and the characters in the book?
Oh, goodness. That's a big question. The family tree, family tree was drawn by the daughter of my godmother, Sian Weldon. She also drew the map by hand. We decided to put a family tree in so that you could really see the lost generation, so that you could see... because they sent lots of men to the First World War from the same villages. So I just wanted to show the background that the people had come from and show the loss. And so we made the family tree so that it had these sort of four tiers of different parts of history. And then we have the Maris family, which is Harold's family. And Harold's really the kind of main person in the book, but... he's married to Esther, he lives with his grandmother Catherine and his uncle Joe. But really, although Harold probably is the main character, I think it very much is a book about different people living together. And really, one of the things it kind of says is no one ever is a main character. We're all on our own little journeys together at the same time.
Mm, wonderful. So the book is written, it's poetic. I started reading a book straight after, because obviously one of my jobs is reading books, and it was just, your book is just, it's transcendent, I don't know what the word is, but it transcends, it's not like normal writing. That's a compliment.
Thank you.
Does that make sense to you, though?
Well, it's... lovely to take in that you feel that. Thank you.
No, it's really, it's all, I mean, really it's about landscape, isn't it? And it's about your love, obviously. I mean, their love of it, but obviously that's from you. Mm. But you say that you're brought up in London. So how does that work? But you're brought up in London, but how much time did you or do you spend in Cumbria?
I kind of go there as much as I can, really. And I think I was brought up in a very strong fell walking tradition, really. If you've got a problem on your mind, go and let the wind blow the cobwebs out of you kind of tradition. We were always Cumbrians in London.
I love it.
No question. And we were always from a different class, breaking ground. And we always went back as much as possible. Obviously, when I was younger, I went back to my mum's family, who are from the south of France in Provence. But after my mum died when I was six, which was really sad. Yeah, she did.
That's terrible.
It was really, really, really sad.
Do you remember it?
Oh, I remember it, and I remember her. God, she was so lovely.
Well, she looked anything like you. She's beautiful.
Oh, thank you. No, she was just a lovely woman, and even her friends are still
And were your mum and dad together then?
They were in a sort of not sure, trying to work things out, handling the 60s,
mess.
You know, and also, you know, Dad was a northern lad who'd never been exposed to this kind of thing, so they were handling that as well. And sadly, she died, and my Cumbrian grandmother became my second mother.
Wow.
So we just went up north for every holiday, and she would often come and stay. And that they just took me in. The extraordinary part of this story is that my dad's mum was fostered, because her mum had a child when you weren't allowed to be a single parent, and she spent her life in service paying for another woman to bring up her child, which was really sad. And my grandfather, his mother died when he was seven from TB.
Similar journey. Yeah.
So they really knew what I was going through, and they just kind of folded themselves around me. Granddad was from a family of six. And the bit of grace that came with that is that I got taken up into a time when the north-south divide was really strong. So it was like going into Victorian England.
Yeah.
Plus my grandparents' generation. So I would stay with my great-auntie Mary, who had gas lighting and an outside toilet. And that was normal for me. So I got to see a very different part of, belong to a very different part of life, that when I would come down to London with my North London mates, it's a completely different world.
No, that is incredible. So you literally, as you say, it's an Edwardian kind of upbringing you had.
Yeah.
So you at the beginning, you spoke in some sort of Cumbrian dialect. So did they speak in it?
Well, I didn't speak in it, no, but that generation did. So I had, you know, you learnt it because you were around it.
Because in the book, obviously, there is quite a lot of dialect, but I found it really easy to understand. I mean, I am from Yorkshire, and it was like, do you ken and things, and I thought, that's what they say in Yorkshire.
Yeah.
But I was just wondering, whether I wonder if other people will think, oh, what's this about?
It was really hard to work out what to do, because in the book I tried to give just a sense of the rhythm and the lilt of it and the beauty of that culture. Mm. You know, part of the question I had when I was writing the book was, how do we keep these extraordinary traditions when times change so fast? Well, how do we do that? But so I tried to kind of keep a sense of the language. But honestly, if I wrote Broad Cumbrian, no one would have understood a word.
No.
So it's very, very, very mild. And there are certain words like I, which I think people would recognise and be okay with, hopefully.
So sheep are obviously, they're also starring role in the book. In fact, I was terrified all the way through it. I won't say the ending, but that they were the ones that were going to suffer, because it was kind of always hinted at, you know.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about relationship between people and sheep? And the farmers in the book, are they shepherds?
Mm. Gosh, that's a really good question. Are they shepherds? I'd say yes. They're hill farmers, shepherds, probably in the old-fashioned sense of the word. Certainly their generations know what it's like to bring the sheep down from the fells into the local markets and then back up again. So they know about feeling a sense of pride that you are providing for the community and wanting your rams and your ewes to be really, really good, to show the kind of really good work that you've done. So they know a time when a woman and a man or a family were able to work really, really hard and have something good to show for it that gave them integrity. And this family then goes through a time of industrialization. The north-south divide starts to close, and their decisions slowly stop being their own.
Mm-hmm.
They become part, I would say, I hadn't thought of it like this really before, but you're such a good question. I would say they then become part of a government farming culture, which is quite different to the old sense of being a mm-hmm. northern shepherd and being able to make your own world.
Yeah, it was like you're being sucked into the system, and you're not even mm-hmm. sucked into it, you have to abide by the rules. That's yeah. what's tragic about
yeah.
it.
And the other tragedy, the other layer of the book, is that the rules become very generalised. So, and no one really, and even now, the people I know there complain that no one really listens to the local knowledge. You know, so even when they went after the period that this book is set in, they went into conservation and would maybe ask people to seed certain trees on certain land. And the locals say, well, that's all very well, but on my side of the hill, it's all shade. You need this kind of tree instead. Yeah. Why doesn't anyone ask me? You know, so there's that that side of kind of how do they really listen to it. And of course, there's another theme, is that a generalised, very well-intentioned probably way of keeping something called sheep scab from spreading, which is a terrible disease.
That's what I was worried about.
Yeah, exactly. And it is a horrible disease, and it was in Ireland. It was very bad in those days, in the 70s and 80s. But what happens is a very blanket control from the government comes to use organic organophosphate dips twice a year, and it's checked by police. So that feels very invasive to the farmer. But also, organophosphates were made for chemical warfare in the Second World War and attacks people's nervous systems. And people are living with that even now.
It's, yes, and that is part of the story. Now, I want to talk about Catherine, the grandmother, who I found, she was very high church, very, very Christian, very pious, but also I was wondering whether all her rituals and everything, were they kind of folklore as well?
Oh, gosh, you've got some great questions. You really read it.
Yeah, I did. I'm not fake.
Thank you.
Yeah.
it's so interesting. I just love how feisty she is, that she does these rituals, but she has her own take on it, and she won't suffer fools.
God, no. I was quite terrified of her, actually.
Yeah. She's a strong northern woman, the matriarch, really. I think that all religion has folklore and storytelling and the treasures that family pass down in it, especially if it's alive. I think religion suffers when it gets really dogmatic and tells you this is how everyone should do it, and it becomes stale. But when religion's alive, it becomes imbued with lots of people's messages and experiences across the generation. So you can go into doing even something like, I don't know, cooking for Christmas. And you'll know that your mother, your grandmother, your great-grandmother and your great-great-grandmother all probably did the same thing and maybe even thought about the same stories. And there's this weird little trick that people do with the salt, putting it in the corners before you start, that was probably passed down from three generations when that lovely Catholic woman came over from Ireland for work, joined the family and brought her small things that were lovely to pass on. I think that's what makes something really precious, but it also is what makes daily life rich.
Exactly. No, and so can we talk a bit about folklore in the area?
Mm.
Is it still around?
It is. I think it's quite exciting. I think it's going through just about to go through a revival.
In what way?
Well, I don't really know, but what I'm seeing at the moment is the, especially the younger generation, are wanting to reclaim a sense of community and identity. And lots of people think that's what Brexit was about. I've had some funny interviews asking if my book was a response to Brexit. I'd love to write that quickly, but no. But so I feel that there's a sense of wanting to reclaim it. And what's lovely about that is then they're doing it in their own way. We've got Jacob Polley just won the Eliot Prize. He's a Cumbrian poet. Mm. We've got some really interesting. The Good Shepherd came out. That was a little while ago.
That was brilliant.
Now there's suddenly my book, and there's just an interesting poetry world with Ian Macmillan, and
also imagine food as well. People are starting to make their own food, cheeses more, and you know, I think people are doing their own thing, aren't they? They're saying, I'm going to make sure this farm survives, so I'm going to do something myself.
Well, that's the trick of surviving as a farmer now, is becoming very entrepreneurial about your product and showing how unique your product is. And the only way any of us are unique is from our local stories and sharing what we do have, and not trying to pretend to be something greater than we are, actually realising that the treasure is just in front of you. So that's what they're doing. People are making beautiful woolen products and milks and cheeses and making a successful go of farming.
Now, I am intrigued, and this is a question I've just thought about, is how is your book going down in Cumbria? And is it accepted by them? That must be terrifying, actually.
It was. I was worried because I just, you know, and you love a place so much, you want to do it proud, you know, but they've really taken me in, which is fantastic.
What a
relief. Yeah, I'm doing quite a few book festivals there this year. And
you've been on the local radio and stuff.
I've been on Radio Cumbria. I'm going to be on again in May, an hour-long interview there.
Wow.
Doing event at Bookends in Carlisle and Borders, and I'm doing a keynote speech at Maryport Festival, and I did the Words on the Water Keswick Festival.
Wow.
No, they're being lovely, really lovely.
Oh, this is so brilliant, because you're bringing something back, which is probably a thrill.
It's at a time when people are exploring what a Cumbrian voice is like, and I'm a next generation down. You know, my dad was a writer, is a writer, but he writes in a very different way with very different ideas. Now I'm a different generation writing, and I think that's what people are. Just really pleased to be in conversation, because when I did the Words on the Water Festival, I came out of the theatre and there were about 85 people in a queue.
Mm.
And what was absolutely lovely about it is they all had little stories to tell me and had time to have a bit of a chat while I signed their book.
Did you remember them? Could you get a recorder? You know, because these stories are probably the ones which are just the most fascinating thing.
They really are.
In fact, you could nearly do a book, couldn't you, about sort of just voices, the last conversations of the Cumbria, you know, the old people or something.
Oh, that'd be lovely. Yeah. That'd be a great thing for radio, actually, go around and interview
really
them.
Good. Yeah. Maybe I should come up.
Yeah, come up.
Let's talk about you now, because I was interested in the book anyway, being a northerner myself. But then when I looked at the back and I saw about your priesthood, your Ignatian, whatever it is, these expressions, I don't really understand them. I just thought, this is an incredible woman. So unusual, you know, to meet someone who really is obviously religious. And I want you to tell me, what's the difference between a priest and a vicar? And what is a priest?
Well, a priest is someone who's ordained. There are different, you know, different churches.
Do you wear a dog collar?
I do. I'm an Anglican priest.
Yeah.
But I don't have a parish at the moment, so I'm working kind of freelance across lots of parishes when they don't have a priest.
Mm-hmm.
And I still do a week every now and then at Westminster Abbey, where you live in for that week.
Oh, and how wonderful!
It is amazing. It feels such an honour to do it.
Yes.
And do you remember Mrs. Dalloway?
Well,
I used to be obsessed with that book when I was a teenager. So my first night there, I remember just listening to Big Ben all through the night, thinking it was wonderful, and then very quickly realising that I was going to have to get some sleep.
Amazing.
So you do that, and you do the services all through the day, and you're around to talk to anyone through the day, and you get people from all across the world wanting to take confession or bless rosary beads or about things.
You see, confession and rosary beads, I think of it as Catholic Church. And I did think it was really interesting in the book that there is a confession scene. And I was going to ask you, in fact, now I can. Can you confess then in an Anglican church?
Absolutely, yeah.
So why isn't it everywhere, and why don't people do it?
Well, people do it, but it's in the high Anglican tradition. So the Anglican Church has got kind of a low church where people are much more interested in kind of Bible readings and maybe even new hymns, all the way up to high church where it's lots of ritual. It's often called bells and smells, lots of incense. You might even sing the gospel because the idea is that the poetry and the rhythm of it has just as much of a sense of grace as it carries the content if you really go into the old King James Bible poetry of it. And that's the tradition that I've studied a lot and that I'm from. Although...
What, in Cumbria, that's where you're from?
No, that I've been working in the kind of 15 years I've been... priest, but I would say, but I do often do services for other traditions, and I'm not precious about it. I want to do the right thing for whatever that group of people need.
So you're not the sort of kind of like vicar that, oh no, I wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. That's the opposite of being a kind of generous person, isn't
it? Well, I'm not sure that's what the priesthood really is about.
So is Anglican, is that Church of England then?
Yeah, okay. I mean, okay. I couldn't be a Catholic priest because they wouldn't accept me.
In fact, you must be half Catholic. Sorry, because you're...
I am. Did half I know? French Catholic. Traitor. Yeah. But, you know, in obviously Westminster Abbey was built way before the Reformation.
Yeah.
So in the Chapel of Edward the Confessor, which is behind the high altar, which is exquisitely beautiful, was, you know, built... 1066, that tomb. And that was a Catholic place of
So when you're there, you're taking both those worlds in, aren't you? And in fact, our roots are Catholic then, aren't they?
I'm a real believer in roots and ancestors and that there's this kind of sense of passing on tradition. And if we step in line, we receive so much more than we could ever work out in one lifetime.
Now, I want to ask, how do you have a spiritual life? I mean, obviously you've really gone for it, as in it's become your job. But how would one have a spiritual life in the 21st century if you were kind of you or me? Do you know what I mean? As in a normal person, how could I bring it into my life without thinking, ooh, this is weird?
Do you mean without it being overtly religious?
Yeah. Or being religious, how... Do you just go to a church? Is it scary? You know what I mean? I'm just trying to encourage people or get people to kind of dare do something different.
I think the first thing to say is that I completely and utterly understand why anyone would throw away religion because of the damage that it's done. I felt that myself. What happened to me was a rebellious streak suddenly came out, realising that the powerful people had kind of talked me into what religion was, and actually religion is by the people, for the people. And by colluding with their idea of this damaging religion, I was giving them power. So I think for me, I went back into studying Christianity and theology and decided to find out what I saw there and what was really good for the soul and good for me, and to reclaim it. So I really meet a lot of people who've thrown away religion for very, very good reasons.
Because they're angry. Yeah.
But they're angry and they think it's let destructive. And, and anything used for power is destructive. Mm. Although we do that with pretty much everything.
Yeah, politics.
And I think the big question is, what are your roots? What's your line? What really inspires you? And how can you reclaim it and give yourself some kind of a structure? So that there's a structure that you think, all right, I'm going to have a go at that. I'm going to have my routine. And then you live with it for a while and let it become almost habitual so that you're seeping it in, a bit like a good poem, and let yourself kind of, your life unfold with it.
Now, I know that you studied religion. So during your studying, you had a calling. Did you have a spiritual experience or was it an intellectual experience?
Gosh, that's... Phew. I'm not very good at detached intellect. So for me, intellectual experiences can be quite fiery. I just find it extraordinary. And I just know I haven't... One lifetime isn't going to be enough to learn as much as I want to read and learn. So I don't really separate the two, but I If I'm really honest, I think it's a bit, it was difficult putting myself forward. I didn't have any archetypal image of a female priest in my mind at all. But it was very, sounds very corny, but it was just love, really, falling in love.
Oh.
I don't know how else to say it.
Why is that corny? That's what life's about, you know?
Yeah.
And you found yourself, you found your roots, as you say. You went through,
yeah,
obviously, an emotional experience. Yeah,
I did. I think I just found this is where I belong, and this is my tradition, and it's beautiful.
Now, I'm interested to know, are there many women around in this world? Obviously, because this is a women's radio station, you know.
In the world of a priest?
Yeah.
There are increasingly now.
Great.
Thank goodness, you know, we worked so hard to be allowed to be bishops. It was only 20 years we were allowed to be priests, but that was on the agreement that we would only ever be led by a man and could never be a bishop. Because, of course, the church was exempt from the 67 Sexual Discrimination Act. So I could be in meeting, and was in meeting with, you know, 30, 40 men, the only woman, and I could be asked to leave and be told that I shouldn't be a priest, you know, and not unlike my friends who were lawyers, who didn't, you know, were allowed to, would have been able to sue.
Yes.
But I had no rights. But in that way, do you know, I really got to be so grateful to my grandmother's generation, who tied themselves to railings or just did small things. I didn't realise how hard it was for them. I certainly would. I'm very proud to say I'm a feminist because I'm so grateful. I don't take it for granted anymore.
So have you found it at all sexist in your work?
Of course.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I've worked a lot also as a coach, therapist, with women, CEO, women who are in the business world, maybe even a CEO, and it's still very sexist. There's
so are they looking for spiritual guidance, or are you doing emotional work with them?
Not great at separating the two, but I would say how to really be authentic and whole and pave the way to leave a legacy that you're proud of.
Well, I know that your dad must be really proud of you for writing the book. It's called Towards Mailbreak, and it's published by Chatto & Windus. Mary Elsa Bragg, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you so much. It's been a wonderful conversation. Thanks for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. And for more wonderful conversations, go to radiogorgeous.com. Thank you.